getting it moving. There is a point at which observing and noting give way to prototyping, that is, to rough expressions of an idea. When people hear the word prototype, they may think of a full-scale mock-up of a product, program, or design. If we look at it differently, as a less formal everyday activity, when you map out the possible structure of a presentation you'll be making on behalf of your team, you're prototyping. If you do it legibly enough for someone else to look at, then it's simply a more effective prototype because you're making it easier to elicit comments from others. A prototype doesn't have to look pretty. It just has to get your idea moving a bit beyond the contours of your brain. Thomas Edison and Henry Ford prototyped all the time, and often in real time. On one occasion, Ford visited Edison at his laboratory in New Jersey, and they talked about the problem of developing an electric storage battery for the automobile. Ford later recalled, "As I began to explain to him what I wanted, I reached for a sheet of paper, and so did he. In an instant, we found ourselves talking with drawings instead of words. We both noticed it at the same moment and began to laugh. Edison said, 'We both work the same way.'" They sure did. They both understood that prototyping should begin as early as possible in the process, not just when it's time to show clients a few carefully crafted versions of what's being developed. We'll have more to say in the next chapter about prototyping in the context of developing particular ideas. What we're underscoring here is the value of early prototyping, which, often in tandem with recording, begins to set your ideas in motion. Tangibility is the essential quality of any prototype. That's what allows you to start thinking in practical terms about an idea, to start getting a picture of where it might take you. At the same time, because prototypes can be very rough versions of an idea, you can think more freely and seek to innovate more boldly. You can move ahead without the fear of failing that is too often a killer of innovation. Creating something that another person can evaluate is the other key advantage of tangibility. It's the secret to effective and efficient conversations with people who might be able to help develop your idea, whether they're members of your team or a friend or acquaintance in another line of work. Making the idea more understandable and with as many details as possible allows people to offer feedback that's faster and more precise than they'd normally be able to give in a short conversation. Making a prototype also helps you begin to get a sense of which ideas may have legs. The ideas aren't sitting there. They're spinning into action, even at a very early stage. You're getting feedback, which should be gratefully received, testing and reshuffling ideas, and setting new ones in motion, all as part of a cycle of continuous improvement. Prototyping is one of the regular exercises of the hunt. Observe yourself. In addition to paying attention to the world around them, all idea hunters need to observe themselves. Personal experiences, likes and dislikes to start with, are a potential source of professional ideas. Think of Scott Cook, who came up with the idea for Quicken, the personal finance software program, after hearing his wife lament the tedious chore of paying bills the old-fashioned way. Recall also, from the introduction, Puneet Nanda, who developed the Firefly, the toothbrush with flashing lights after noticing his daughter's delight in her sneakers with flashing lights. Being sensitive to your own experiences, alert to your desires and frustrations, is a well-established path to innovation. Another case in point, Phil Schiller, the Apple marketing whiz, and the motivations that led to the creation of the iPod. Schiller explains that iPod project members began not with a grand notion or marketing plan, but with a passion for music combined with frustration surrounding the dominant portable music player of the time, the Sony Walkman. "We were so sick of it that we felt compelled to create something," he told a small group that gathered to hear him at Boston College in November 2008. Sometimes personal experiences are profound. Paul Hogan, chairman of Home Instead Senior Care, based in Omaha, Nebraska, comes from a large extended family. He has 11 aunts and uncles on his mother's side. Hogan was glad for the strength in numbers when it came time to care for his grandmother as she became progressively weaker, finding it hard even to get out of a chair. He says his aha moment came in 1994 when he wondered what other people do when they don't have ample family resources to help look after a loved one. That's when Hogan and his wife, Lori, founded Home Instead. My family had learned that it's one thing to prepare a meal for a person who lives alone, but that it's something else entirely to have someone there to encourage the person to eat that meal. Having someone there to give reminders about taking medications is also helpful, he told Patricia R. Olson of the New York Times. Companionship is important too, and it is another of the many non-medical services that Hogan's company now provides to 60,000 clients worldwide. At other times, a personal experience might be hardly classifiable as profound, but nonetheless useful. Sir Richard Branson, the colorful founder of Virgin Atlantic Airways, recalls that during a flight he took before starting the company, "I wanted to talk to a pretty girl in the next aisle, but I was stuck in my seat the entire flight." That is why Virgin Atlantic now has stand-up bars in its cabins. Branson added in a 2006 Fast Company interview that he went into business originally not to make tons of money, but because the experiences I had personally with businesses were dire, and I wanted to create an experience that I and my friends could enjoy. Translating such experiences, whether dire or not, into business ideas is a habit every professional can cultivate. There's another sense in which self-observation is important, when it comes to evaluating your progress as an idea hunter. We have devised a self-diagnostic tool for quick and simple use. You'll find it in the epilogue. For now, it's worthwhile to take a clear-eyed look at these factors. 1. Your level of curiosity, whether you're interested in both the substance of your work and other people's work. 2. Your breadth, whether you're consulting a wide diversity of sources. 3. Your habits, whether your idea search is steady rather than sporadic. And 4. Your positioning, whether you're putting yourself in the line of fire of great ideas and building these ideas as you go along. Such agility will be the focus of the next chapter. It becomes clear that this isn't something done once in a blue moon. It has to be part of your daily exercise routine, nurturing the habits of the hunt.